Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Glad you could join us for our podcast. Want to welcome those that are listening maybe for the first time in this new year. And we are happy to have with us today Jim McDermott. Jim is a senior HR leader, has led organizations, HR organizations within companies such as Medtronic, and was most recently the CHRO at CryoLife. He's going to share thoughts around talent management and how to manage your career. And he's got some great insights he's going to share with us. Looking forward to our conversation with Jim. First off, can you give us just a little bit of your career history and background? We'd love to hear your story.
Sure. Well, I was going to the University of Toronto back in the early 80s, and I stumbled into a class back then. It was called Personnel and Labor Relations. And then I quickly decided this is where I want my career to be. So my coming out of the, in Canada at least, or in Ontario, coming out in the early 80s, the job market was not that great. So I ended up taking a job as a recruiter for what would now be known in the U.S. as Sears. I stayed with them for a couple of years. Then I moved on to the oil and steel business with a company called Shaw Industries as their employee relations representative. And that exposed me to a lot of opportunities in the U.S. We had two sites there. Then I moved from there into, and I did a lot of moving around, into the defense contractor business with Rockwell International, which was kind of fascinating. Stayed with them for a couple of years. Then I got hooked into the defense contract business with Rockwell. And that business ended up shutting down. And I went into the industrial and power management business with a company called Cooper Industries, which is now called Eaton. And that job actually was an interesting job because it moved me to the States. I moved from Toronto, a very large cost, to a 2,000-person town in North Carolina. And when you think about your career, that was a life-changing career because it was all new in terms of employment law, employees' rights, employee privacy, U.S. labor law. I stayed with them for about 8 years, and then I went to Chicago for the pulp and paper business with International Paper, and I really enjoyed working for International Paper. And then in the late, mid-90s, the guy that I worked for at Eaton Corporation worked for Medtronic, and he lured me to work with him again. I spent close to 20 years with Medtronic, in and out of a number of jobs, in a number of their businesses. When I finally left them, my last 7 years there was as the group vice president of HR for the cardiac and vascular group. I retired in the spring of 2016, and that lasted about 3 months. An individual that I worked for at Medtronic became the CEO of a company called CryoLife, and I went to work with him for the last 3 years. And just recently retired again for the second time. So there's my background. So I worked for him as the chief human resource officer for a medtech company, and that was another career changer in terms of understanding working with a board, et cetera.
That's good. So one of the questions I always ask our guests, if you could, looking back now and over your career, if you could go back and talk to a 22-year-old Jim, what advice would you give him knowing what you know now?
That's a really good question, Mark. I would say, the first thing I would say is learn to do the job you were hired for and get a track record behind you. If you sometimes, not all, but there's a number of the career ambition, make it the better part of judgment. Do your job, put some numbers on the board, get a track record. Secondly, and this is, I've heard this in some of your previous podcasts, is always work for a leader that will challenge and grow you. That's really important. Insecure leaders, they stifle you, they want to take them, and you're not going to grow from them. I would also say it's tough to admit you don't know the answer. And I think that's not only for early careers, talent, but even senior talent is, recognize you don't have all the answers and recognize it's okay to ask that I don't know the answers to that. And then secondly, I would say don't be afraid to take chances on new opportunities. Instead of saying, I don't know how to do that job, why don't you tell yourself, I can learn this job and here's how I'm going to do it and put a plan together. I think opening up, there's many things. And learn to do it, learn to find a job that you're passionate about rather than one you're good at. Because if you're passionate about it, you can learn how to do it.
So thinking back to some of your first roles that you had coming out of college, what are some things that you learned quickly that you didn't know and you wish you would have learned earlier?
I think one of the lessons I did, the last comment was I remember I was somewhat afraid to say I didn't know the answer. But then I had a really good boss, a guy that I worked for at Eaton and the guy that brought me back to Medtronic, a fantastic leader, that he would always tell me, just if you don't know, I'm here to help you. That's why I'm your boss or your manager. And I wanted this was a performance management system. We could do this. And he paused and he said to me, okay, there's a lot of good ideas. You need to go back to the drawing board and tell me, how is this either going to, in a for-profit business, how is this going to grow the top line, increase revenue? How is this going to improve the bottom line? Or as an HR professional, how is it going to enhance our ability to identify, attract, develop, and retain the best talent? And if any of these ideas you're coming up with doesn't do any of those, I don't want to hear about it. So it's like, make sure when you're working on something, what problem are you trying to solve? Or what solution that people need that maybe they don't know yet are you working on, rather than this is a good idea and it's kind of neat. I've seen over my career as a number of folks come forward with ideas to a solution of a problem that doesn't exist. So I still to this day will say in any team I've managed, tell me how it improves the top line or the bottom line or enhances our ability to identify, attract, develop, and retain the best.
Speaking as far as of hiring, and you've seen this over your whole career, new leaders coming in and hiring their executive team or their team around them. What mistakes have you seen leaders make in that hiring process?
I would say, hiring people like you, hiring people that, resonate with you and your values. Mm-hmm. I think that's a downplay. On the flip side of the coin, I would say always look for hiring a very smart, bright, team, people that have different skills, maybe better skills than you have. I would also say, it's easier to manage a team with the same value, works, and training. That's not creative. A high performing diverse team will always outperform a high performing homogeneous team. And I would say, a diverse team, and don't think about diversity more around there's gender and there's ethnicity, but generational, geographical, educational, get that kind of diversity around you. With one caveat though, a diverse team is tougher to manage because there's so many ideas and thoughts and different angles coming at things. Make sure your team has the skills and you have the skills to appreciate that diversity of thought and embrace it. And that every individual team members knows they're part of a team, but they also have their individual accountabilities. And you can get through that through a role mandate or RACI exercise. But as I said, a high-performing diverse team, you can't be. But you got to make sure you're aligned and everybody appreciates the diversity and you have a way of making decisions and reaching consensus.
That's good. So are you, as you look back over, once you have that team in place, and how do you measure that team and performance management? Talk a little bit about your thoughts around that. And I know you've been involved in even some experiments that different organizations have done over the years, but talk a little bit about that and lessons learned.
Well, I think it's important. Like the traditional performance management system, let me first talk about that. I would say the performance management, I think when you think about performance management with your team, the traditional performance management system, they would generally, you start with the beginning of the year with your set of goals. You may, if you're good, meet mid-year, maybe even quarterly if you're world class. But in most cases, you set your goals at the beginning of the year, you meet at the end of the year, you as the employee write up your goals, you submit it to your manager, and they're usually in the system. And this is not a judgment, but usually a system where you're forced rank on a bell curve and you're either on a 5-point scale, you might be 5 to 10% exceptional, high contributors would be a 4, meets expectations of 3, below expectations of 2. And then poor or needs improvement at 1. And that may or may not work depending on your culture. But if you're working with a team, to your question under that, make sure they know that, I'm operating under this system and what exceptional looks like, because a lot of people think they're exceptional, but they're not. And in my experience, there's a lot of people that are exceptional, but they break themselves, I meet expectations. So that's one way of doing the organization. I think, and you alluded to a different way of, so if you have a team like that, you make sure under the traditional organizational system, you're pretty clear. You check in quarterly. Where are you with your goals? Be flexible to amending goals, because I have never in my life started at the beginning of a career with a set of goals that haven't changed over the year. Could be a divestiture, could be a crisis, could be a safety issue, and you change your priorities. If I was building a team and I had my druthers on how to manage their performance, I would get away from an annual performance review. I would do a quarterly check-in. I would say at the beginning of the quarter, you may have 10 things on your plate, but these are the top three priorities. I need you to work on this quarter, so let's get aligned around priorities. I check in at the end of the quarter. That's how did you do on the three? What else did you do? Then I would have this discussion around next quarter. But I would not put anybody on a bell curve. I wouldn't say, you know, only 10 to 15% are exceptional. I would, and at the end of the year, you know, right after the review, I think when I give somebody a number on the old system, and I come in and I think I'm a four and you give me a three, I've stopped listening. I've gone into defensive mode. I found it, and I want to be very careful, it was, you know, the system has to fit your organization, what you're trying to drive. But if I was building a team and I had my druthers, I would go to that system, check in quarterly. I would give you feedback at the end of the year, or quarterly, but at the end of the year, I would use words, and you could just describe where you are by the words I would use in a performance review. Instead of giving you a number, I might say, you have met all my expectations. You're a great player on the team. Another person, I might say, everything I give you, you knock it out of the park. You've made exceptional contributions this year. But I'm not giving you a five. I'm using the words. And I think that number, there's some stigma attached to it. Now, what I've just said is very, very controversial. I know some organizations have gone to it and come back. Other organizations have gone to it and stayed with it. But in my experience, if you can build a really diverse team and you want to keep them motivated, at the end of the year, if you put them into a system where I got to pit people against one another, and an analogy I use, and I'll pick on Canada where I come from, it's the Canadian soccer team, the Canadian national soccer team. I could bell curve them and they'll be an exceptional player on the Canadian soccer team. Then I might take the German soccer team, and not one Canadian can make that German soccer team. I'm probably going to get in trouble with my home country for this. but if I reversed it, hockey would be the other way around. But they would not. So why take it? If you're a good manager and you hire nothing but what I said at the beginning, smart, motivated, talented people, they could all be exceptional. I don't have to pick one against the other. Yeah, but that's a delicate way to do it. But I said, if I was building a team, I would try to say to my organization that, you know, I'm going to rate your performance against your performance, against the goals you and I set, not against how well your teammates are doing. And I think that system that I just spoke about, quarterly check-ins, no number, no bell curve, it's gone from a fixed to a flexible system. It's gone from looking to the past to looking to the past and the future. It's more prospective than retrospective. And you've gone from, I think, more of a making a judgment on what number I'm going to give you to more of a partnership. And this is what we agreed. You know, you've done this here, you've done this here. And I think it makes the manager be more of a coach and less of a controller. Mm.
So that whole idea of coach, mentor, you've had mentors that have been, I'm sure, your managers in the past that you look to as somebody that you're learning from. How important is it for that HR function to really take a look at, you know, are we aligning people with some good mentors, some coaches that can help them as far as to get beyond, you know, where they're at for that at the end of the year?
I think mentors are very important. I've had them over my years, and I've been a mentor to a number of people, and I've been a mentee to others. I've learned a lot. And I think, you know, what we did when I was with Medtronic, which was a large organization, is mentors would be trained on how to be a mentor. You know, you're not an advocate, which is a little bit different. You could have an advocate for you, trying to fight you for positions. But a mentor is, you know, kind of, I look at it as a mentor is more of a person that says, okay, sharing your experience and helping them reach a solution. I'm a certified coach, and I'm a certified Medtronic coach when I was there. And what I find about coaching was a little bit different. Coaching, I'm not giving anybody answers. I'm helping them find the answers themselves. If you start as a coach, I look at a person as they're naturally creative, resourceful, and whole. So they know they have the ability to solve that problem. And I don't want to give them the answer as a coach. Give them the answer as a mentor role. A coach is to say, you know, do you know where you're going? Do you know what's important to you? Do you know what trade-offs you're going to make? Are you balanced? Are you happy in your career? What changes do you need to make? And it's do a series of what I would say powerful questions and taking people up into the stratosphere and looking back down and doing them better. And I found that to be very invigorating. We launched in the CBG division, we launched an internal coaching program that actually eventually went to corporate. And there were a number of people that signed up to be certified as a coach. And then your obligation of going in as a coach is every quarter you had to train another, you know, top talent, a pillar talent, an up-and-coming, early identified high potential. And I think we got a lot out of it, both in terms of the person being the coach. You bring that back into your management style, that I don't have to give the answer. I can help somebody come to the answer they want. And sometimes you have to give the answer. But and in the other cases, I think individuals learn to think on themselves rather than giving the answer and getting the answer to the question. I have to think about how I'm going to get that answer. So you become more self-sufficient. But I think any organization that really develops a talent, they will have a coaching program, they will have a mentoring program, and then they would have an advocacy program. And an advocate means I might have someone that I'm going to fight. I'm higher up in the organization. I'm going to see opportunities for them. I'm going to advocate for them because I know them. I know their talents. And they may be, you know, some people are great talents, but they're not a good advocate for themselves. They don't ask for the positions. So I think a good talent management system to make sure you're growing the right people and the people that deserve it are given the opportunity. An advocate is another thing I would consider doing in the organization.
So I just saw the new conference board survey that they did, and this probably ties into that last section about mentoring and growing your staff, and that's around retention. And is that a part of the retention? Do you see that as a key part? Is people seeing opportunity to grow and to develop? But talk a little bit about that. What are some of your thoughts around retention?
Oh, I think not only on retention, but the idea when I talk about your ability to identify, attract, develop, and retain, mentoring and coaching is a key component. I think there was some data that we had with Medtronic that under coaching and mentoring programs, the ability to retain talent, you know, especially talent out of school, out of maybe top schools and top graduate schools that were growing and developing their skills, they're likely to stay versus you got to feign for your own. But I would also say your ability in that conference board thing to, I've always, as a HR professional, as a CHRO, I would look at my ability to attract and retain the best is driven by my culture. What kind of culture do you create? And mentoring programs and coaching programs are part of your culture. They talk about the value of people. That's telling you you have a culture of I want to grow and develop talent. And I want you to stay with us because I'm going to expand your ability to, you know, learn new things. And so I think, to me, if I go into any organization, I would say the first question I would ask, I'd ask it when we started CBG and I asked it when I went to CryoLife is, do you have the right culture that enables you to execute the strategy? And as I said before, my catchphrase, right culture to execute the strategy and identify, develop, attract and retain the best talent. And you got to ask yourself, the way you do that is I would say you do an assessment of your culture. And how does your culture operate now? And one way to look at that is I've always said, if I can go into any organization and as a consultant now, I've gone to organizations where if I look at who's hired and who's let go, I could probably tell you a little bit about the culture, who's making it to the top, who's stalled, and who's, you know, kind of forced out. The other thing to do on culture is you could do assessments. And one of the things I did with an organization I was working with was I looked at the career promotions track and the people that were kind of pushed out of the organization. I also looked at all the exit interview data, and they had some good data in terms of why people were leaving. I also looked at the Glassdoor data. Mm. And, you know, yeah, there's some good data there. I put a caveat that most people write on Glassdoor or complain about something versus advocating for something, but that's just normal behavior. Then I did an engagement survey, and then I did a Denison, there's a number of cultures, but the survey I used was a Denison cultural survey. It talks about how flexible your culture is, how static it is, how customer focused it is. Or is it a learning organization? There's a lot of issues around communication from the top down, you know, the cascade of information down to fewer jobs. There's a lot of confusion around what customer focus meant. Because if you're a sales rep or a marketing person, you kind of know what customer focus is. And so we had this value of customer focus. But if I'm a shipping clerk or I'm a cost accountant, tell me what that means. So I think you assess your culture, you determine the culture you want, then you have to operationalize your culture through operating principles and making sure every employee, regardless of what their job is, knows what those operating or core values are. Whether you're a cost accountant, shipping, an HR rep, a plant manager, what does customer focus look like for me? And then I think attracting, if you're an organization, you hold leaders accountable for the culture you want to create. And they got to talk about it. They got to say what they're expecting. They got to behave. They got to walk the talk. And then they got to operate those cultures into their operating process. Really focus mostly on the what you do. I mean, I get my goals at the beginning of the year, and I can reach those goals. But if I leave a wake of dead bodies in the process of getting the goals, that's not sustainable. So I think culture is more about the how versus the what. And you need a balance. I mean, the what and the how, I think, would come together in some sort of scale and say they are equally or close to being equally valuable.
Talk a little bit about just that move from a large organization like Medtronic, a global organization, to a smaller organization. You had a CHRO role, and just what was that like, and what did you learn from going from a Medtronic to a smaller organization?
There are a number of things I've learned. I learned in a big organization, you are surrounded by expertise, centers of excellence. Hmm. One example I would give when I went to CryoLife was we had acquired a company in Germany, and we were going to move some people over to Germany. And in my old Medtronic world, I would pick up the phone and call corporate relocation. They were staffed with a dozen people and say, I want to move Joe from here to there. That was the end of my exercise. In a smaller company, there's much more, and it's not good or bad, it's just different. You have to roll up your sleeves and say, now I have to find a consultant to do this. And, so I relied a lot on my old Medtronic colleagues. Where do you go for this kind of expertise? Because it was you before. I also learned in the CHRO role, the idea of being an officer of a company and an SEC officer where my every move or trade was recorded, that was a big learning curve. And I think what I learned, I now appreciate for the CHROs that I had at Medtronic, I now appreciate much more the degree to when there's a board meeting, how much work, endless work and presentations to the board need to be flawless. They need to be absolutely perfect, and the amount of work and reiterations and prep for those board meetings. And so when I was sitting in my world of being the group leader of the cardiovascular group of Medtronic, which is a big group and a lot of responsibilities, and then the CHRO over my career never disappeared for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, and I'm wondering where they were. I now know where they were. You're getting ready for a board meeting, and the operating principles on the board, the governance that has to go with that board, I have very little appreciation for, but I now quickly learned. So, and I had to tell my team, and this is something I learned from a leader, a CHRO at Medtronic, was I was very clear with my team that I'm going to be, 25% of my time is going to be with the board. 25% of my time may be with my boss, the CEO, and 25% of time with his leadership team, and maybe 25% of the time with the HR team. I can't be there all the time, and that may ebb and flow depending on the time of the year. When you get into end of the board years or board meetings, and they say I'm going to 50% of the time I'm gone, and you're not even going to see me. So I need you to be self-sustainable. But that I found it was much more variety, much more roll up your sleeves, get into the details. at a smaller organization like CryoLife, and at Medtronic, it was, you know, a mega expertise, a lot of people around you, but maybe your job was a little bit more narrow focused.
That's good. So talk about some of the books you've read over your career and things that you would books that you'd put on any leader's reading list.
So actually, I would say on a leader's reading list, anything that Jim Collins writes, who did, you know, Built to Last, Good to Great, How the Mighty Fall. I think his research is impeccable and it's flawless. It's relevant. It's still relevant today. When you look at an organization and his concepts of the flywheel, get good at one thing and make it happen. And he actually came. Jim Collins at one point came to Medtronic and spoke to us about what does Built to Last look like? And I think anything he does there is well worth it. Then I would say, I'm reading a lot of things now about leadership. I'm reading some of the ex-Navy SEAL, Jocko Willink's, on the economy of leadership, where, you know, it's not, are you a micromanager or you're a free-for-all? And the answer to that question is no, it depends on it. It's interesting, my oldest, and think about books, a long time ago, I read The One-Minute Manager, and my oldest son, I was at a house recently over the holidays, and on his desk was The One-Minute Manager. And it's still back about, you know, walking out, making sure you show yourself, that you're available and present, that you're not sitting in your office with the door closed. And I think that's still relevant. The other one, I would say, very early on in my career, I read The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And I still think those 7 habits that Covey talked about, you know, begin with the end in mind, be proactive. One of the fifth value was seek first to understand, then to be understood. And I think in today's world, where I see there's such polarization, you know, on one side, you're either left or right, or you're right or you're wrong, or in this polarization, if we had a principle, you know, habit number 5, seek first to understand and to be understood, I think the world and organization would be a better place.
So outside of work, I know you've retired twice. What do you enjoy doing to recharge?
Well, thanks for that question. I've now been retired for the second time. I bought one of those Peloton bikes, and I'm finding it fascinating. I can't wait to get on the ride. When I bought one, most people, despite the controversy wishing with that commercial, I get on the bike, and I remember the very first time on the bike, I was riding, and there's a leaderboard. And, you know, when you go to the gym and you're working up by yourself, that's kind of, you do that. But on the bike, there was this, you see this leaderboard, and I was actually riding, and I said, okay, this is my first ride. I just want to be up in the 50th percentile. And it was a kind of an intermediate ride. And then, you know, my code name was, Ready to Race or something. I had Ready to Race. And somebody passed me, and they waved at me on this board. And they had really an awkward name of something spandex. And I won't say the other word. And I said to myself, that's not happening. He's spandex is not passing me. And so I upped my game, and I'm finding getting better shape by competing in Ethernet races. The other thing I did, Mark, was I took up golf again. I gave up golf 10, 12 years ago. And people that don't golf don't understand the game, but I've taken that back up. I've taken some lessons. I actually played yesterday, and I think there's that game's just as much mental, if not more mental than physical. And it's one of the few sports that, you know, the score is your own. And finally, to unwind, I love watching movies. I'm a big, not heavy movies. I love kind of, you know, Star Wars and Marvel comics and DC stuff. Any of that stuff comes out, I'm there, because I lose myself in those movies. But yeah, right. Those are the things I'm doing. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, maybe Mr. Spandex is listening to the podcast, so
you know, yeah, I was very careful. He's going to call a full name.
So, any parting advice you would give a leader that's up and coming?
I would like to say I thought about what I would say, because I listened to some of your previous podcasts, and I thought I'd like to tell a story if I can, and it's related to the 7 Habits. And in the 7 Habits, he says everybody should have a mission. So it was I was just starting my career. I was out of school. It was 1988. I was engaged to be married. in later that summer in that year. So in early January, I decided I want to, you know, reflect on what I want my life to be and what success, what my legacy would be. And so I locked myself in my office. And back then, my office was the desk in the bedroom. And I spent, you know, I spent Friday, Saturday, and Sunday kind of come up with a mission statement. And I wrote a mission statement that talked about my values. And I defined them as integrity, respect, empathy, courage, and self-control. And I divided my life and I told what I, you know, my mission was to enrich the quality of life of others through my professional and personal pursuits. And I divided my life into family, my immediate family, friends and community, and business. And in business, I had a statement that I wanted HR to play a major role in the organization. But one of the things I wrote back then, and I think it's when you, and I'll go to the family side. And I wrote this back in January of 1988, 32 years ago, I guess. And I wrote, in terms of family, what I wanted, what success looked like was, and I'll read it. As a husband and father, I will ensure my family finds peace, joy, security, and comfort in life. I will encourage each member to expand their horizons and develop their own unique talents. My home will serve as a place of love, laughter, and learning. And so my advice to people early in their career is very important. I have a segment on what my career was going to be, but I think determine, you know, take time early on to figure out where you want to go, how you're going to get there, and by that, what kind of values are you going to define your legacy? And then what you want at the end, looking back, you know, what does success look like? And in terms of my family, I define it as a place of love, laughter, and learning, and developing unique talents. And I'll leave with this. I've had a number of people always come to me and say, can you talk to my daughter? I think they really should go into marketing because they're really creative. Or can you talk to my son? I think he should go in finance because he's good with math. And I've always backed away from those. Don't determine by sitting down what you want to be, what you want to do, what you're passionate about. And don't let somebody else's notions about what you're good at should be what you do. And you only do that by self-reflection and taking some time to think about it.
That's great.
Thank you.
That's great advice. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for taking time out, Jim, and wish you continued success with all you do.
I appreciate the time, Mark, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.